welcome everybody to our Sunday night sitting group. I am in the just finishing up doing a retreat here at home with Joseph Goldstein and Kamala Masters. It ends this evening at the closing ceremony is at 8. So we might wrap it up just a little early so I can get back to that. So this evening I'm going to be including in my talk and our discussion some of the points that Joseph and Kamala have been and Pascal have been touching on in their Dharma talks during the course of this retreat. So, you know, hot off the presses, you know, fresh off the Dharma griddle. It's been a very moving retreat, and as any of you know who've done Vipassana retreats, and even in this home setting, you know, if you stick with the schedule and stick with the practice, it can take you to pretty interesting places. And we'll actually be talking about that over the evening. So, first off, let's do some practice together. So as we know, in doing this practice together, it doesn't really matter so much if you're sitting on a bench or a cushion on the floor or sitting on your on a chair or maybe lounging on the couch. Whatever way of settling in to do some practice together you're finding to be the most beneficial for your purposes tonight. Oh, welcome. Welcome. So, let's take a moment here and settle in. And as we know, what we like to do as we settle in to sit is to focus on a couple of aspects of the actual, you know, physics of sitting. First, is to take just a moment to more fully come into the presence of your own body, to realize what it feels like to be in the body, okay? And to allow our attention just to kind of gradually sweep over the body, you know, the muscles of the face and the neck and the shoulders, arms and hands. Noting any tension that might be being held there and beginning to allow it to relax a little bit. Muscles of the chest and back and pelvis. Muscles of the legs and the feet. Muscles of the throat. And then checking to see that we're centered, comfortable and at ease. Centered forward and back and left and right so that we're lined up, you know, and also sitting up straight, the other aspect. Sitting in a way that allows the energy to freely flow and for us to wake, you know, stay awake and alert. Then allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Whether we mostly feel that as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, or maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the ocean surface on a calm day. Taking some deep cleansing breaths if we need to stay awake and energized. But other than that, simply letting the body come into a more complete and deep state of relaxation. And just as the Buddha advised, simply noting the breathing as it is. Whether you're taking a long breath or a short one, a deep breath or a shallow one, a rapid breath or a slow one, simply attending to the breathing as it is. Its rhythms, its depth, and its pacing, as well as any ways these may fluctuate as you come into ever deeper states of relaxation. Relaxing the body so that it can more easily breathe itself. Welcome back, everybody. Do we have any announcements of any upcoming Sangha-related or other Dharma-related activities that anyone would like to share right now? No.
Lloyd, I actually have one. If no one else, please.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen.
If no one else has one. So Aya Damodira is leaving Colorado. She is going to head a monastery, the Mahapajapati Monastery, near Palm Springs, California. And I'm hoping that she'll continue to give Dharma talks to us. She is definitely going to give the talk on August 16th. So,
okay.
We wish her well.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I'll reach out to her and ask that, you know, if she has the time in her new position, if she can still be a part of our Sangha from time to time. Anicca, change.
Yes.
Okay, anything else? Well, it's kind of a mixed bag, isn't it? The situation we find ourselves in with regard to the contagion and needing to not be able to gather, you know, in large groups as used to be the case when it came to residential retreats. But like Joseph is saying this afternoon at the retreat that I've been part of, what it does provide for is a lot of Dharma practice opportunities that didn't exist before, because all these teachers, these really skilled teachers, as well as new ones coming along with a fresh perspective, are offering a lot of online teaching, including full-on retreats like the one that I'm just completing this evening, where they suggest a sitting and walking schedule that you can adhere to the extent that your home situation allows it, with these really wonderful Dharma talks and chanting and chants and Brahma Vihara practice and really rich stuff that is just as straight up Dharma as anything you might get in person. So really encourage folks to see what the offerings are at Insight Meditation Society and Barry, Spirit Rock in Northern California, Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, which is also in Massachusetts. Just go to any of their websites, and there's a lot of really neat stuff out there to partake of if you want. Also, like, way cheaper, since you're not having to spend money on travel and you know, room and board. So check it out. So I've been doing a few of these over the course of the last few weeks and months. Yeah, the one today, this is Jenny. I did one a while ago with Joseph and Sharon, two of my teachers and friends. And then a few weeks ago, I did one with Monte Analio, who is a Theravada teacher that I've come to learn a lot from, both in terms of the fact that he's really a great scholar of the Pali Canon, but also a deep practitioner. So I've learned a fair amount. A few weeks ago, I did a retreat with him that was on the Brahma Viharas and emptiness. The Brahma Viharas, of course, are the mind states of selfless joy, compassion, open-heartedness, equanimity. So there are, in fact, these very wholesome states of mind, and there are, in fact, practices that you can do to not necessarily make them happen on the spot, but at least create conditions favorable in the mind for them to arise when the time is right. But the retreat was on the Brahma Viharas and emptiness. That's the English translation of a Pali word, shunyata. And that means emptiness, or it means voidness, okay? Voidness of self. And the practice of shunyata, is one where it becomes possible to relax the mind not only so that it ceases to construct self, but that it also can cease to construct reality in a way that the mind normally does. In the Dhammapada, it says, you know, we become what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. And so when the mind gets to that state of relaxation, then sometimes it can feel like the world itself is dissolving. But just as often what happens is that you just see the world with the kind of a freshness and clarity and brilliance, because what's been removed is this filter where you're looking at the world in terms of what you want from it or what you don't like about it. You know, there's an aphorism in the Hindu tradition that whether a pickpocket is in a crowded bazaar with other shoppers or a holy temple with other worshippers, he still sees only pockets. Relationship between perception and motivation. So the paradox here is, okay, so you're cultivating these mind states, right, while also becoming more and more aware that there's no one doing the cultivating. So how can this be? How can you have an aspiration to realize these states and exert the effortless effort, you know, the energy to realize them? Where does that come from if there's no self setting the goal and there's no self-observing energy? So that was the relationship between those two, is sort of the centerpiece of the retreat. And one of the things Analio talked about in looking at this, you know, how does one cultivate these wholesome states of mind from a place of emptiness? He said that our starting point, you know, whether it's beginning a retreat or beginning to practice the Dharma at all, you know, practice and study the Dharma, we begin in our comfort zone, you know, this place that the mind has created, the discursive mind has created, that we feel is safe and protected and invulnerable, right? And then when we begin to practice, at first it's practicing just enough to feel comfortable and at ease and peaceful and all these things that to the outer world are the goals of doing any meditation practice, including Buddhist practice. You know, chill out, get calm, smile. And basically, you know, don't pay attention to things that bum you out. So that's the superficial external view. However, when we decide that we're actually going to do this stuff, what he talks about is that we leave the comfort zone, you know, the little walled city or walled town, and we go out a little bit into the unknown. It's what the Buddha meant when he talked about going forth. That's going forth from your comfort zone. So that going forth had basically two meanings back then, just like it does now. One was the encouragement or the invitation to go forth to those who wanted to become full-time followers of the Buddha. So it was going forth from home life or normal everyday life and becoming a member of the monastic Sangha. But at the same time was also an invitation to householders, for those who were not ready to leave home and family. That, and by that he meant it's possible to go forth internally, to leave the fixed place of sanctuary that the discursive mind seeks to establish, and go forth internally and find refuge instead in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. So he described, Nalayo did, the comfort zone, the little walled town, and then going forth into the unknown. He also talked about the outer limit, you know, going out to the place beyond which we're afraid to venture, where the opposing forces seem to be too strong and the effort is too much. And he said that this limit really needs to be respected. Just like the limits on the body when we do yoga, you know. There actually are two ways to do yoga, and one is the, you know, the beneficial or healthful way, and the other is the harmful way. The harmful way, and I, of course, am speaking to some extent from painful personal experience, is you see the yoga teacher doing an asana, you know, moving into a posture and then inviting you to do the same thing. And so especially when I first started out, I said, okay, well, if I'm going to be a good yogi, then I have to make sure that my body can get into the same position that the yoga teacher's is. No matter how many times they would say, just, you know, approximate this, you know, find your, you know, move into it and then until you find your limits. Still in all, I would really, you know, I had some egoistic idea of what it meant to practice yoga perfectly. And so trying to force my body into positions it was not ready to be in was kind of a recipe for damaging the body, right? Which, yep, a few times. That's exactly what happened. Only with practice did I come to learn that the purpose, unless the body is really flexible and limber and open, is not necessarily to make your body look like the yoga teacher's, but rather to move toward, to aspire towards that asana so that you can receive its benefits to the extent that your body is able to take them in. And so you relax and open, and you know, and so getting into these requires some one set of muscles to exert strength and another set to relax, all the while opening and softening the body until you can get into what your version of that posture is going to be. And that's where the benefit of the practice comes in. Just so, said Nalayo, with regard to Dharma practice. Okay. If you're reading the text and it talks about, you know, dissolution of self and whatnot, you feel like I've got to keep hammering away at it until, you know, I achieve some particular state of mind or other, that is a recipe for psychological harm. It's a recipe for harming yourself. because you have some notion of what kind of yogi you ought to be, or what kind of state you ought to be able to attain, rather than simply exploring how far you can go without hurting yourself or harming yourself. And when he was offering this retreat on the subject of shunyata, on the void, on the experience of non-self and the dissolution of reality, when that happens, for some people, when they get up close to that, it can, and it happens through progressively deeper relaxation of the mind, it can bring a sense of dread and sometimes even panic. And that's a signal that it's time to stop, that you're taking it further than the mind is ready to experience. So for those of you, for instance, who, for those of us who may have some experience with psychedelics, we know that the skillful way for them to be used to be a benefit is that, number one, you trust the substance. Second, you have a skilled guide. And thirdly, you're in a safe setting. You're in a place of refuge or sanctuary. And then there can be experiences that are revelatory and freeing, you know, and increasingly psychedelics are finding use in psychotherapy. You know, there's a lot of really interesting research about that going on at places like Johns Hopkins and UCLA. Same is true with allowing the mind to get so relaxed that it begins to deconstruct self and then begins to make reality itself kind of weighty. That's the kind of thing you only want to do on an intensive residential retreat with a skilled teacher and in a setting where you have taken the refuges, you know, where it's really safe to do so. And in addition to that, Onalio is among several of us Vipassana teachers who've come to the understanding that there are some people that should not be doing Vipassana practice at all. You know, if for people who are already challenged in terms of maybe borderline personality or schizophrenic tendencies or something like that, it's really best to do calming and gentling practices like the Brahmaviharas, like mindfulness of breathing, but not these kind of deeper practices that take one to the edge of the void. So these, whatever our limits are in the practice, they really need to be respected. What Onalio was using this concept or this analogy to say was that as we go forth, as we leave the comfort zone and move into the wilderness, you know, that we need to do so ever mindful of what our own personal limits happen to be at the time. So the first venturing forth might be a few steps outside the gate of the town walls, you know, a few yards, half a mile or so. And then we get comfortable doing that, and gradually it becomes possible to go further and further afield. So we have a map and a compass, you know, but these are only tools to help us navigate into areas that we may see a picture of it on the map, but we haven't experienced it in real life. And that's a pretty good analogy for what it means to really invest oneself in the Dharma and take it where it feels like you want to go. So interesting things happen in this process. One of them is this. This is a book called Nice Fish. It's a book of poems by Lewis Jenkins. And this one is called How to Tell a Wolf from a Dog. A wolf carries his head down and tail down. He has a look of preoccupation, or worry, you might think. He has a family to support. He probably has a couple of broken ribs from trying to bring down a moose. He's not even getting workman's comp either. And no praise for his efforts. This wolf looks unemployed, flat broke. On the other hand, a dog with similar features, maybe a husky or a malamute, has his head held up, ears up, looks attentive, self-confident, cheerful, and obedient. He is fully employed with an eye toward promotion. He carries his tail high like a banner. He's part of a big organization and has the title of man's best friend. So, when we're inside the little old town, we're the, we're the family dog, right? And then every once in a while, we decide we're going to take out for the wilderness. We get a little feral, and we become more like the wolf, right? A little riskier, you know. And it's kind of like, you know, when we go on a backcountry trip, you know, we learn to go further and further afield. We have new experiences, learning the terrain, developing our backcountry skills and self-confidence. We do it occasionally in the company of others, you know. We come back maybe kind of worn out and tired, but not quite as beat up as the wolf and knowledge, right? Because there's something really enlivening about venturing into the unknown at the same time. Another interesting dynamic in this analogy that I've come to discover as well is that the borders aren't static, you know, which is to say, as you become more and more comfortable going forth and venturing into the unknown with the map and the compass, you know, and based on your own experience of having been down that trail before and taking it a little further, what happens when you turn to come back home is that you find that the comfort zone's expanded. That territory that used to be unknown and a little frightening is now familiar. And so the realm within which you feel at home, within which you feel at ease, has suddenly become broader. And furthermore, as you go further into the field and you know, where your outer limit used to be, suddenly it's not there anymore. Suddenly it's a little further out. Okay. And so it's as if, like the expanding universe, it's like the whole thing is in the process of getting a little bigger. The comfort zone expands until the wilderness doesn't seem so wild and doesn't seem so frightening, nor does the limit when you reach it. And that's a pretty interesting place. That is a place of, that's when you find that you are inhabiting that realm. You realize that something has really changed about your relationship to the world. The Sufi poet Rumi characterized it in this way in a poem called The Great Wagon. He said, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in the grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. People are going back and forth across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. So So it's an interesting field to explore. And that's the one that the Dharma invites us to have a look at and hang out in. So Anālaya is using this metaphor to describe, you know, the inner exploration that's involved in spiritual maturation and liberation. But it also applies to socially engaged Buddhist Dharma, because that's also a venture into the unknown, you know, leaving the comfort zone, testing out our ability to apply wisdom and compassion to healing the self-inflicted wounds to our society and our environment. So I want to provide and sort of example of inner exploration from the retreat that I'm just now coming off of, and then turn our attention a little bit to outer exploration in terms of bringing the Dharma to bear on the circumstances that we find ourselves in now in our society. So as happens on these retreats, when the mind gets really still and settled and you just open up, you know, you send the sensor off on a Hawaiian vacation and you just settle in and you really begin to say, okay, I want to be here for what arises. Okay. So when I did that, I found my own working edge, the place where I had come to a place where there was no longer a trail, but where I knew that there was still work to do. A lot of things came up, but one of the things that came up was my dynamic of working with gender fluidity and having increasingly come forth in the portrayal or the sharing in a more open and visible and external way of my feminine aspect, you know, including, you know, changing my name so that there's, you know, so that the hyphen name Tara and Loy equally expresses, you know, both aspects of my personality. And what I discovered when I really looked at the internal dynamic was that there was actually quite a lot of internal struggle and internal difficulty. As you know, when you go deep, you know, in something like a retreat setting, these kind of powerful, psychologically energized sort of visions or characterizations can kind of come into being. And one that came up pretty strongly for me was that of an adolescent girl. When I was a really young boy and began to exhibit some, what would be characterized as sort of feminine characteristics, or not, this was Southern Arizona in the 1950s, especially if there was any acting out of the femininity, I'd be pretty severely punished physically, whipped, you know, and told in no uncertain terms that that's not the way boys acted. You know, that was wrong. Furthermore, it was sinful. We were Southern Baptists. And on occasions when I would be discovered in the process of self-exploration, you know, like in bed at night, I would again be, you know, severely whipped for having done so. And so I learned to live in terror of my own body, you know, and its senses and its urges and whatnot. And that was just sort of how it was. But then suddenly when adolescence came along, it was an incredibly confusing time because I was really drawn to girls and, you know, still happily heterosexual. But there was also this feminine side that wanted to be there, that wanted to come to the party as well, but couldn't. And so I spent pretty much my entire adult life with that feminine sensibility and that feminine presence, essentially incarcerated. And so, and furthermore, a deep sense of shame and guilt and self-doubt accompanying it. So just 3 years ago, when I decided that, you know, that this, the depression and the anxiety, you know, I didn't want it, you know, my life to come to an end this way, and so came forward, there was this sense of freedom of having gotten out of jail after, you know, 60 years or so, and freedom. But it was like somebody who'd spent 50 or 60 years in jail. You know? And so what I came to realize is that there was a certain amount of resentment as well. You know, there was resentment against the culture. There was resentment against that part of myself that had kept me incarcerated, right? So I was angry at myself for the way I had been treating myself for nearly all of my adult life. The part of me that had been the jailer or the policer or whatever who had kept me incarcerated was likewise pissed off. Okay. And so as I would, like, internally and silently while I was sitting, I kind of give voice to these various forces that were happening. And then the jailer would say, well, now you've gone and done it. You know, here you are, you know, running around showing off your femininity and the cat's out of the bag, and you've gone and disempowered us culturally. You know, you're not at the top of the cisgender heap anymore. So you have disgraced us and shamed us. So all those voices, all those a lifetime's worth of self-judgment is still there. And I found that the male and female aspects of who I am were really kind of at each other's throats. And it was really sad, you know, it was painful. And at the retreat, you know, in a talk that Joseph gave about self-judgment, he said that, you know, you need to see it for what it is. We feel that it's somehow an intelligent voice or the one that has been keeping us in line all these years or has been establishing and maintaining our identity. And he said that those voices, those self-judgments, they're not coming from a place of knowledge. They're not coming from a place of wisdom. They're coming from a place of delusion. They're coming from a place of self-aversion. And the ways that we tend to relate to self-judgment either are to believe the judgments, okay, that's who we really are, or to feel a very strong aversion to them, or sometimes both. And he said, in some ways, this feeling self-aversion towards self-judgment is more difficult because it really fuels the dynamic. It just makes it that much stronger, makes the self-aversion that much more painful. What happens then, if you're working with this within the framework of the Dharma, is that eventually through this kind of investigation, you recognize just from the practice of mindfulness, this is dukkha. This is the first noble truth. This is where it's coming from. It's the cause of dukkha, craving. Craving for things to be different than they are, wishing that I were not self-judgmental, wishing that I did not believe these judgments when they arose. The antidote, what disempowers the self-judgment, is acceptance. Not approval or buy-in, but acceptance. This is what's going on. This is how it is now. And when that occurs, when you see that it's the mind causing suffering for itself, and you see it for what it is, and you stop resisting the behavior, what's going on, and fully accept it, what happens is that the floodgates open, and the harshness and the dukkha associated with self-judgment is pretty much washed away in a flood of self-compassion. Oh, here I've been causing this terrible suffering for myself through this self-judgment. Now I see it for what it is. Now I've accepted it as a habit pattern of the mind. You know, Joseph said he worked for years with fear. And the reason he couldn't shake the fear is because he was feeling aversion to it. And at some point he finally said to himself, you know, if I have to live with this fear for the rest of my life, it's okay. There's that acceptance. And then it began to dissipate and went away completely. And that's what happened for me, you know, in terms of just seeing it for what it is and the power I've been giving it. It began to relax and dissipate, and self-compassion really began to flow forth. And it also began to flow forth for everyone I see around me who's similarly engaged in that kind of self-judgment. So that freedom is possible once we see the nature of the self-incarceration that has been created by the self-judgment. So what I'd like to do before going on to the next part is to open up and ask if anyone has any questions or comments about anything that I've just finished saying, and whether there's some slight possibility that some of what I've said might sound a little familiar or might have some parallel with your own experience. So please, if anyone would like to share either with a question or a comment, now is the time when you're invited to do it. So you can just unmute and share if you wish. Okay. Going to keep it under wraps. That's all right. Kirsten, unmute.
There, can you hear
me? Yes.
You were punished as a child.
Yes.
Who punished you, your father or your mother, or both?
I'm not sure how deep to take this one. I was subject to improper early childhood sexual contact with my mother, and I was severely, severely physically punished by my father. Yeah. And so something like that really stays with you, you know, it does.
Of course.
And the psychotherapists that I've worked with off and on from time to time, you know, talk about how one of the things that can classically happen when we come to adulthood is that we internalize the kind of conditioning that was imposed upon us by our parents, that we kind of become our own parents, you know, our own harsh father, our own loving mother or whatever, and that we carry that around with us. And so a lot of, like Tara Brach in her book, Radical Acceptance, she says, holding yourself in the heart of the Buddha, she says, a lot of what we seek to do is engage in the process of reparenting. You know, we kind of seek to become for ourselves the parents we never had. So we can take better care of ourselves in the present moment. Yeah. Okay.
And excuse our parents. May forgive our parents, maybe.
To the extent that that becomes possible to do. And not beat ourselves up if we cannot completely do so. You know, again, that's that can be a limit that needs to be respected. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay.
Gloria, what?
Oh, Gloria, please. Unmute, Gloria. Okay.
Okay, I think I am now unmuted.
Yep, you are. Yeah.
I just, first of all, I wanted to thank you for sharing. And I was, while you were talking, I was thinking of my own coming out process and how different it was. Because I didn't have the safety of the Sangha and the safety of the practice. But I did have a way to obliterate them because I was drinking alcoholically at the time. And oddly, I think it served for me as a kind of, I don't know, as a substitute, a very bad one, for the safety and comfort of Sangha and community.
Yes. No, I've been, as in the course of my own continuing growth and working through some of the issues I'm talking about, I also have had to come face to face with substance dependency, and for me it started out as soon as I got home from Vietnam. You know, it's like, at least now I can, put a happier face on and just say, well, I was self-medicating like crazy. In my case, for the most part, it was getting stoned a lot. I do now. This book I'm reading, Good Chemistry by Julie Hollander. She's a physician and the former chief of medicine at the psychiatric ER at Bellevue Hospital in New York, so she's well qualified to speak of these matters, and she is very into various derivatives of cannabis as a way to do all kinds of stuff, cure or skillfully work with PTSD, depression, anxiety, and alcoholism, among other things.
And what was her name again?
Julie, I'll toward the end of our set, I don't want to distract now, but toward the end of our time together, I'll put it up in the chat. At any rate, yeah, like, you know, I think, you know, and if it's either that or live in hopeless isolation, in the closet, you know, there are times when I can understand alcohol being an ally, you know, and if at that time it was what you needed in order to be able to get to where you were, then it did its job. Of course, as we know, for any of us who, you know, have had or have issues with alcohol, it's like drinking seawater to quench your thirst, right? It might feel like it's doing what you need at the moment, but eventually you realize that it's only making matters worse, and that eventually you have to let that one go as well. So, I appreciate your sharing, but it's, in some ways, it's completely understandable, you know. So it's like Bhante Thanissaro Bhikkhu, he's a Western monk, and he said, you know, we have this notion that when we take a Buddha Dharma, well, a source of suffering is clinging, and so, okay, well, I'll stop clinging. You know, it doesn't quite work that way. He said, step one is to just get more strategic in your clinging. Instead of clinging to material objects or food or, you know, various recreational substances, start clinging to the idea of enlightenment, right? So you realize that that's not necessarily all that skillful either, but at least it heads you off in the right direction. You learn the shortcomings of, you know, that approach as well. So, right. Yeah. But you're here, you're healthy.
Yeah.
We're all in this together. All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else want to share? Okay. So, now turning from this look at how we self-incarcerate individually, to how we self-incarcerate as a society or as a culture. When Tocqueville was touring America in the 1830s, before he wrote his book, Democracy in America, came away not having a very high regard for the South, in particular with, we always like to read the parts of Democracy in America that are flattering, all the things he liked about democracy. We tend not to read the things he put in there, where he basically said that America has within it the seeds of its own destruction. One was the attempted genocide of indigenous people. He said that's a sin for which I think this country may never be able to forgive itself. And the other one was slavery. And he said something that was remarkably similar to what the Buddha said. The Buddha said, in war there are no victors. And the reason for this is because those who have been defeated are humbled and they are oppressed. And they are at the will of the winners. The winners likewise are incarcerated, are captured, because they live in constant fear of overthrow by those that they have conquered. So there's a state of continuous tension. Tocqueville said the same thing about slavery in the South. He said, the slavers, the slave owners, are incarcerated, are imprisoned, are enslaved every bit as much as those they oppressed. They are likewise, they are also enslaved by the institution of slavery, because they are the ones who must enforce it. So the way I dive into my exploration of issues like this as a scholar is always say, well, what if I wrote a book about that? And so the working title for the book of my mind is Colonial Karma, and the subtitle is Buddhism and Caste in America. And so, basically, the thesis is the same. It starts in kind of the same place that Isabel Wilkerson does. It says, that, except I pay a lot more attention to British colonial caste as well. So we have the caste system from the time of the Buddha. The British found it very much to their liking when they colonized India, because there was a built-in slave labor force, or a hierarchy of different forms, different strata of society. And in fact, the caste system was legally most severely enforced during the time of British colonialism. They brought the same model to the United States. We didn't have any built-in slaves like they did in India, so they had to go buy a bunch of them in Africa and bring them over here. The first generation of slaves in America were treated as prisoners of war, because in fact they'd been kidnapped. And so they were kept against their will under the laws of war. And the slave rebellions that occurred early, were ones where they felt like they were fighting an army that had conquered them. And the slavers in South Carolina felt exactly the same way. It was only generations later, after enslaved people had lived there and had gotten to become there, that they were able to fully enforce the caste system as they had come to know it in India. The way the caste system worked in the Buddha, it said that he didn't come out like in a political way and denounce the caste system, but he came pretty close to doing the same thing, because what he said was, regardless of the form of government, whether it's a monarchical kingdom or whether it's a tribal republic, and those are the two main forms of government in his time, both of which supported the caste system. He said the problem with any system, and the real problem with the caste system, any system of government is subject to abuse if they are infused with greed, hate, and delusion. And he said the caste system is particularly vulnerable to infusion by greed, hate, and delusion. The only way to skillfully administer a society that has the caste system is if everyone is treated well. The advice, you know, in the wheel-turning monarch, you know, which is one of the texts that I find myself coming back to a lot, he said it's the obligation of the monarch, of the leader, of those who have the most power in society, to ensure that all are well seen to and that all are well cared for. What happens when a caste system becomes overtaken by the calaces, the three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion, is that the way that the elites engage it and cause it to function is by creating artificial scarcity among the lower castes, so that they are living in constant fear for their own survival. So they have to be kept in a disempowered state. They have to be confined in the kinds of employment they can undertake and the kinds of things that they can do. So when the British brought that institution here, with enslaved African people, one of the things that was against the law in all slave states was to teach any of their enslaved people to read, because that was a form of empowerment. Okay. Within the enslaved populations on the plantations, there were also subcastes in India called Jetties. There were the people who worked in the inside in the household, okay, as butlers and maids and house cleaners and launderers and cooks, nannies, you know, taking care of children. And there were those who worked outside doing, you know, the really grungy, dangerous, bloody, nasty work, right? And so the ones that were working in the big house, some of them were taught to read a little bit. Okay. And they were taught to regard those who worked out of doors as lesser than they were. To some extent, that was successful. After the Civil War, although it was no longer illegal to teach former slaves to read, the states of the South did everything possible to keep it from happening. So we didn't have anything approximating public education in most states until near the end of the 19th century, going into the 20th. And to the extent that public schooling was allowed at all in the South, there were radically inferior educational opportunities for depending on color, right? The landmark civil rights case of the mid-20th century was a challenge to the institution of the caste system of denying equal educational opportunity to lower caste people, especially formerly enslaved African Americans. And so it's no accident that that was the first thing to be challenged. Look at how we fund education today. A lot of, and at future times we can take up things like housing and, you know, employment opportunity and such, but just taking up the realm of public education right now, we had radically, Plessy v. Ferguson at the end of the 19th century, the Supreme Court said, hey, it's okay to have segregated schools and segregated public transportation, segregated everything else, as long as the facilities are equal. Okay. But of course, throughout the first half of the 20th century, they were radically unequal. So in Brown v. Board in 1954, the High Court said, in the realm of public education, separate is inherently unequal. And so they ordered that public schools be integrated with all deliberate speed. What happened in the South, especially white flight out of the public school system, the setting up of private academies to which only white kids could enroll, which left the public schools bereft of funding, left them in some cases even worse off than they'd been before. So it was a replication almost of what was going on in the antebellum years. It was a concerted effort to deny equal educational opportunity to the lowest caste people, to make it that much more difficult for them to become self-empowered and to climb out of their caste status. So that was the case right up until, 19, and later on in the 1950s when governors were standing in the schoolhouse door, prohibiting the integration of their schools, direct defiance of the Supreme Court's ruling. No one really knew whether the Supreme Court's ruling was going to be enforced at all until President Eisenhower in 1957 said, well, yeah, the governor had lined up the National Guard to prohibit black kids from coming into school. And President Eisenhower sent down the 101st Airborne Division. Live ammo, bayonets fixed, standing up against the National Guard. And the National Guard decided maybe they should go home, which they did, and the kids went to school. So that's what it took to at least get the ball rolling as far as equal educational opportunity is concerned. Lyndon Johnson in 1964, up until that time, it had been local control, local funding, and if we want to have segregated schools, then we're going to have people in that way. So there's tremendous opposition to that. So in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that said, hey, you don't integrate your schools, we're going to cut off your federal funding. And a lot of states in the South said, well, big whoop, we don't get that much federal funding anyway. 1965 educational amendments, Johnson gets through the biggest federal funding increase for local schools in the history of the United States. So things start to change, right? Come the Great Society programs, late 1960s, massive federal funding for a program called Head Start, which targeted neighborhoods and public schools that weren't getting the funding they needed for their kids to get off, to even have a chance to make their way. And so that was a massive empowerment of people that had never had that kind of educational opportunity in the past. And it was ferociously opposed and significantly defunded later on in the Nixon administration. Fast forward to the present day, how do we fund public education? Yeah. Well, the mantra still is local control, local control. How does that work out as a matter of practice? Okay. What it means is that wealthy communities can tax themselves at a really pretty small percentage and still have very well-funded public schools with a lot of enrichment programs and training for college prep and things along those lines. Poor districts, okay, where the income is not very much, have to levy a much larger tax on themselves in order to raise a smaller amount of money to at least keep their schools functional. There are schools here in Colorado that do not meet the federal court-imposed guidelines for the constitutional care of inmates in prisons. in terms of temperature control on their cells, in terms of their diet, right? Because of local control of education and local funding of education. So a lot of states got sued, including Colorado, and so we passed a state funding law that's supposed to try to make things a little more equal across the state. And every year when there's a funding fight over public education, that's what the fight is about. It's not the state's obligation to educate kids at the local level. It's the local school district's responsibility. That, whether intended or not, is a great formula for maintaining unequal educational opportunities. So that's just one example of an area right now where if we want to get outside our comfort level a little bit, and if we want to start making a racket about how we fund public education in this state in a way that tries to make sure that everybody, whatever caste they're in, whatever social status they got dealt this time around, is not punished by virtue of the communities they live in or how much money their folks have. That's going to take concerted political advocacy. That's going to take really exerting our own efforts in terms of who gets elected to serve in legislatures, in terms of what kind of pressure we put on them, in terms of our willingness to open our wallets. That's what begins to change things. That's what begins to turn things around. So, just one example. We're coming up on the end of our time together. I need to go grab a cup of tea before I go to the closing session for the retreat that I'm part of. I wish to thank you for coming around this evening. And please, if we could take just a moment to settle back into our sitting postures. And allowing the eyes to gently close. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth through the doorway where these two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep.
Thank you, Lloyd, Tara Lloyd.